Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Hellas Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Robert Brantley, author of Sacred Ground, Cemeteries of New Orleans. We'll also hear from John Warner Smith, Louisiana's new poet laureate. Great to welcome photographer Robert S. Brantley back to The Reading Life. His photographs have appeared in numerous books and publications such as The New York Times, Metropolis, and Preservation, and he's the author of Henry Howard, Louisiana Architect. Today we're talking about his new book, Sacred Ground, The Cemeteries of New Orleans. Robert Brantley, so happy to have you back at The Reading Life.
Yeah, it's great to be back, Susan. Thank you.
Now, you've been photographing cemeteries for a long time, just bit by bit. And your interest really began when preservationist Mary Lou Christovich asked you to come with her and clean cemeteries on Saturdays.
Yes, at the time I was working at the Historic New Orleans Collection, and she knew that I had been out photographing in the cemetery. So I got a phone call one Friday afternoon and said, "Oh, I'm picking you up tomorrow morning, and we're going to go clean cemeteries." Well, we cleaned cemeteries for over a year. I would have to climb on top of some of the tombs to cut trees out of them. It was a unique experience, to say the least, especially with her. And during the course of that, she became a very close friend and a mentor and someone who remained a close friend the rest of her life.
And I'm sure a great teacher, because she knew so much about cemeteries that she was probably imparting to you all the time.
Yes, she was, always. And we did this whether it was raining or not. It was a lot of fun, but incredibly hard work. The satisfaction of going in and cleaning up the different cemeteries was just very rewarding. It made you feel good when you walked out.
You knew you were doing something good.
Yeah.
Now, there's so many books about New Orleans cemeteries, and everybody might think, why? Why another book? But this one is very different. It goes back to the very beginning of our history and the culture that's grown up around funerals, burial customs, and the business. And Fred Starr has written this wonderful introduction to your book. And one of the things he does that's so interesting is take us back to the beginning of the city when people were figuring out how to do things. And one of the big problems is, how do you take care of your dead? And burial posed real problems in New Orleans. And he points out those factors that made a difference.
Yes, he does. When it first started, they really didn't know what to do. There's a story about burying on a makeshift levees in the back of town, which was Rampart. Mm-hmm. They created a cemetery called St. Peter's, and that lasted up to about 1810. And then they started disinterring the dead from there and moving them over past what is now Basin Street into St. Louis Number 1. Mary Lou once told me, she said, several of the wrought iron crosses that are in St. Louis Number 1, she firmly believed that some of them came out of that cemetery. And after looking at them very closely, I think she's correct.
And also, there were so many people to bury because of the epidemics that plagued our city.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was so hard to get granite and marble.
It was.
Down the river to New Orleans.
At the time, up until the mid-1830s, roughly, the only way to get granite or marble into the city was by packet ships coming out of Boston or somewhere else, or England or Wales even. It was not until the advent of steam, when the steamboats started running, then it opened up the limestone pits in Indiana. It opens up the marble and granite quarries in Georgia and Alabama. They could get up to the Tennessee River, go down the Tennessee to the Mississippi, down to New Orleans. And so that's how a lot of the granite and a lot of the marble started coming into town was through the steamboats.
The other thing that's so interesting is that when you think back to the beginning, someone has to organize all this. And in New Orleans, it was the Catholic Church.
Yes, it was the church.
Mm-hmm.
Someone had to do it. And because the city was very religious at the time, you had to be Catholic.
Yeah.
And there was no exceptions to this, you know. The poor Protestants that were actually living here and the Jewish people that were living here had to just not say anything or mm-hmm. pretend that they were Catholic.
Now, one of the unusual things that you've done with this book, and one of the highlights, is that you've selected 21 people whose graves you photographed, and you give them life in brief biographical sketches. And it's a great range of people, and they're all very interesting and show us the complex kind of makeup of our city. And one of the most interesting is Reverend Emperor Williams, who lived from 1826 to 1896. Why did he fascinate you so much?
When I was working on the architect Henry Howard, I first came across the name Emperor Williams. It was probably in the late 90s, and I didn't know who he was at all. I knew that he was a Mason and he was a slave. That's all I knew. And I started doing some research on him, and I found out just astounding things about this man. He's become a hero of mine. He did so much in his life. I don't think the man ever slept. He started off as a slave. He was sold to an African-American in 1841, who he said treated him badly. Mm-hmm. Then he was sold to a man by the name of James McIntosh, who was with the Jameson McIntosh Builders. And this is where everything opens up for him, because the two men really liked one another. And McIntosh began teaching him how to read and to write, a feat that would have landed both of them in prison.
Right.
And by 1846, Emperor Williams was the foreman for Jameson and McIntosh, a position he held all the way to 1858 when he was emancipated by McIntosh. But he still continued to work for McIntosh until he died in 1861.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Robert Brantley, whose new book is Sacred Ground, The Cemeteries of New Orleans. Another fascinating part of this book comes in the back of the book, where you have an index of the plates, but you decode a lot of this iconography for mm-hmm. the viewer, so that when you're looking at a tomb or a vault, you know what you're seeing. You even talk about what flowers meant in terms of sculpture.
Yes. A friend of mine, her name is Heather Venizano, she helped me with all of the iconography. I mean, she was an expert at it. I knew very little, mm-hmm. and I relied on her about it. You know, some of the things are just self-evident. The weeping willow.
Of course.
You know, which means, you know, mourning and, you know, loss and rejuvenation. But it also means incredible strength, because a weeping willow, in winter, it loses all of its leaves, but its root system is highly active during the winter.
Mm-hmm.
And so when the spring comes, it's a much stronger tree, and it can withstand all sorts of storms. That was one. And the others were the different flowers, for
yes.
instance. You know, that was fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
And when you walk through these cemeteries, you see all of these little decorations on the tomb, and you think, well, they're just decorations. They're not. They're there for a specific reason. Otto Weber was a composer, and on the base of his obelisk in Metairie Cemetery is a scroll that mm-hmm. means composer, a musical instrument, which was a violin. He played the violin.
Right.
And there are other things on that obelisk that also represent his life. Every single thing means something.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk for a minute about the beautiful photographs themselves, because these are duotones. They're not sharp, high contrast photographs. They're kind of dreamy, and they seem to have motion in them. It's a deliberate look that you've chosen, and it's very beautiful.
Thank you. Thank you. My mother had been very ill for a while and had numerous strokes.
Mm-hmm.
And in 2016, the fall of 2016, She had what I described as stroke talk. She would just make no sense whatsoever. And one day I was sitting next to her bed, and all of a sudden she just looks at me and she says, I want you to do something for me. And it was just incredible. She was back to her lucid self.
Uh-huh.
And she told me, she says, you have been taking care of me for 9 years. You took care of your wife, Jan, before she died for 2 years. And she said, son, you don't even know who you are anymore. You know who you are in relationship to caring for me or caring for your wife. She said, pick up that camera and get out of here and go take photographs. You always find yourself in your images. I headed for the cemeteries the next day, and that book began the next day. By the end of the day, I realized that the photographs that I was taking had to be black and white.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the emotions that I had felt back in the early days with Mary Lou Christovich all came boiling to the surface. And I wanted to do something special. I wanted to have other people see the cemeteries like I see them. I see them as a very large outdoor museum.
Yes.
Some of the finest artwork in the city is in those cemeteries. I don't see the rigidity and the coldness of marble or granite. I don't see that.
Mm-hmm.
I see softness to it because I keep it in relationship to grass, trees, and the clouds. Everything around it is the total ambiance. It seems to give these tombs and their artwork life.
Yes.
And that was what I had tried to do. And I had showed a few of the prints to Mary Lou, and she had said, please do something remarkable with the cemeteries. Well, this is not for me to judge, but I hope I've made her happy.
I think you have. There's one incredible photograph at the very beginning of the book that is this double-page spread, a scenarial view of St. Louis Cemetery. Is that number one?
St. Louis number one, yes.
And you did that photograph with a drone.
Yes.
Which, that must have been fun.
Yes, it was. I have a friend who's very accomplished with a drone. Whenever I've seen an aerial or bird's eye view of the cemetery, it's always from the side or from the front. And I didn't want to repeat that. I wanted it from the back.
Mm-hmm.
So my friend Richard pushed the drone up to 110 feet, and we took three photographs, and that was it. And we stitched them together and made one panoramic photograph of the rear of the St. Louis number one with the city in the background.
But it's like our shadow city. It's really wonderful
it
to
is.
See it in its entirety and then see New Orleans sprawling out around
mm-hmm.
it.
You know, they call them little cities,
mm-hmm.
and that photograph really brings it home.
Yeah. Very special. You say you think of these as works of art, and you honor them with art that shows them in their very best light.
Yeah.
We've been talking with photographer Robert Brantley, whose new book is Sacred Ground, The Cemeteries of New Orleans. You can meet him when he discusses and signs the book Thursday, October 10th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop, and then again Thursday, October 17th at 6 at Octavia Books. Robert, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan.
It's a great pleasure to welcome Louisiana's new poet laureate, John Warner Smith, to The Reading Life. A Morgan City native, John lives and works in Baton Rouge, where he teaches English at Southern University and directs Education's Next Horizon, a nonprofit organization dedicated to reforming public education. He's the author of four books, Muhammad's Mountain, Spirits of the Gods, A Mandala of Hands, and Soul Be a Witness, with a new collection, Our Shut Eyes, New and Selected Poems on Race in America, coming later this year. John Warner Smith, welcome and congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you, Susan. Great. Appreciate it.
Now, you've pursued poetry devotedly, but that hasn't been your only career. You've been a banker. You've been a public administrator. I imagine many poets at some point wish they had banking as a day job. So tell us how you've woven those two lives together.
Well, yes, it's been quite a journey. I often say that while I've done other things, other jobs, Poetry really has been the, I guess, the one work that I've done that I'd say has been most gratifying mm-hmm. for me. I earned a living doing those other things, but my passion was always poetry. And, you know, I was sort of tinkering with it many years back while I was living and working in Lafayette. And it seemed that as I grew professionally in these other areas, poetry was, you know, the thing that sort of really kept me grounded.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd always go back to it. I say that it found me long before I found poetry, and when it found me, it just wouldn't let me go. It's been quite personally gratifying for me, yeah.
Now, you've had some amazing experiences. You've studied your craft at the UNO Low Residency MFA program. You've been a Cave Canem Fellow, studied at the Kalalu Writers' Workshop, and you've worked with great poets in all those places. So talk a little bit about those communal experiences and how they've shaped your work.
Well, they really made all the difference for me. You know, my first Kalalu Creative Writing Workshop was in 2005, and I did three of those. I skipped the year after Katrina because I was working for the state and was very involved in the recovery efforts at that time. And I finished up the following year. It was there that I actually met and was taught by Terrence Hayes and other great poets.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had the good fortune a couple of years later of being accepted by Cave Canem on my third try, by the way. Oh, yeah, Cave Canem just made all the world of a difference for me. And I forgot to mention, too, that Tracy K. Smith,
yes,
who was one of my Kalalu instructors, and, of course, moving on to Cave Canem, being in the company of other African-American writers, both new, you know, and emerging writers and more experienced writers, and being taught in workshops by some really, truly outstanding, award-winning poets just lifted me to another level.
And so many great poets have come out of Cave Canem. It's really amazing. And now you pay it forward by teaching at Southern.
Yes. I started teaching composition and African-American literature in my last year of my MFA program, of the MFA program at UNO. And that's a really a love of my life. I'm a born teacher. It took me a while to figure that out. You know, interestingly, years ago, while working on my first undergraduate degree, I had an English minor, right? That's where I really discovered my love for literature and writing, but I kind of rejected all that. I ended up with a teaching certificate in English, but I just kind of filed it away and said, I'm not going to be doing that the rest of my life, right? And so I made full circle. Here I am doing what I really love to do.
Now, one of my favorite works of yours is Muhammad's Mountain, which I imagine was a very intense writing experience, inspired as you were by the death of one of your heroes, Muhammad Ali.
Mm-hmm.
So talk a little bit about writing that collection, which was such it was such a devotional act.
Yes.
You know, as you undertook it.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Well, you know, Muhammad was, as you said, really a personal hero of mine. And when he died, that was a really, really painful experience for me. I had never met Muhammad, knew him as others from watching his great fights and his struggles and his triumphs. And I sat down one day, sometime long after his death, thinking, well, wouldn't it be great if there would be an anthology done of poems written about the champ, right? So
mm-hmm.
I started my search and found what I discovered was that there wasn't a whole lot there, at least on the internet. There was really, I only found like a handful of poems. And it was at that moment that the idea was born to write a collection devoted entirely to him. And so, I don't know, there's probably at least 42, I forget the number of poems in this book. And I wanted it to be somewhat biographical, autobiographical of him, but at the same time capture not just his life, but the lives of others who helped make Ali who he was. And these were, you know, of course, other fighters and, you know, sports broadcasters like Howard Cosell, his family. And then the end of the book really is where I really begin to pay tribute to him and include a few poems there that actually not only capture his struggles, his physical challenges, but his spiritual triumphs and how he actually, I think, achieved a point of self-realization that few people ever achieve. And then there are several poems in which that capture how we pay tribute to him.
Mm-hmm.
So this poem, In the Wake, is a poem that was actually written the weekend of Ali's death. It was June of 2016.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of the book wasn't even born at that time. I wasn't thinking about the book, but I was writing poetry. In fact, I was working on Spirits of the Gods at the time. And I sat down watching all the tributes being paid to him on television and online, and this poem just was written that day. You know.
Would you read it for us?
Yes, it's a short poem. Rain pouring all day, tributes, photo shots, film footage. He floats, he jabs, he whoops ass, he mouths off, he rhymes, he defies, he lights a torch. The greatest is dead. I can't stop the rain. Can't stop remembering a boy, dreaming, shadow boxing, shuffling feet, me pretending to be Ali.
I love that poem.
Thank you.
I can see so many little boys pretending to be Ali. It's magical.
He was our champ, you know. When we shadow boxed, we were shadow boxing in his steps, absolutely.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with John Warner Smith, the new Louisiana State Poet Laureate. So talk a little bit about what you hope to accomplish during your 2-year term as Poet Laureate. What are you looking forward to doing?
Well, the work of the Laureate is really to reach out to other Louisianians and to help spread the good word of how poetry brings value to our lives. And so I'll be traveling quite a bit across the state. I've already begun to do that, doing readings and workshops and listening to other poets even, to just help that appreciation to grow, just what goodness poetry brings. And I would particularly like to, if possible, reach some parts of the state, the poorer rural parts of the state that poet laureates might not typically travel. I don't know, but I certainly would want to do that, given my own personal background, coming mm-hmm. from a poor family and a small town. I'd like to spend a little time doing that. I also believe that, as the first African-American male poet laureate, I have a little special work to do. My mission is somewhat different in the sense that I clearly put another face on poetry. I do that at least in a way that people are not accustomed to seeing. I'd like to help define the meaning and the impact of poetry in ways that people are not accustomed to experiencing, because not everybody, of course, has had that experience of being a black boy, a young black man, a black father living in the South. So I think all of that will be sort of part of what I'm hoping to do over the next 2 years.
We've been talking with Louisiana's new Poet Laureate, John Warner Smith. You can meet him when he reads from his work Wednesday, October 9th at 6:30 at the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities Humanities Center. That's at 938 Lafayette Street. John, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan. It's been my pleasure. Really enjoyed it.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week here in New Orleans. Ethan Brown signs the movie tie-in edition of Murder on the Bayou, Who Killed the Women Known as the Jeff Davis Eight, Monday, October 7th at 6 at Octavia Books. Poet Morgan Parker, author of the poetry collections Magical Negro, There are more beautiful things than Beyoncé, and Other People's Comfort Keeps Me Up at Night, as well as the young adult novel Who Put This Song On, is the Florrie Gale Ahrens Poet at Newcomb College Institute at Tulane University this month. She will read in the Dibble Gallery at the Newcomb Institute on Monday, October 7th at 7 p.m. Graphic novelist Kate LaCour discusses her new book, Vivisectionary, with artist Caesar Meadows, Tuesday, October 8th at 6 at the New Orleans Public Library Main Library, 219 Loyola. Poppy Tooker discusses Insign's Drag Queen Brunch, Tuesday, October 8th at 6:30 at the Hubble Library in Algiers. Today's guest, John Warner Smith, reads from and discusses his work, Wednesday, October 9th at 6:30 at the Louisiana Center for the Humanities, Turner's Hall, 938 Lafayette Street. Historian Carolyn Cobb continues the series, The History of Jefferson Parish, with Part 5, 20th Century Life, Family Life, Politics, Politicians, and Sports, Wednesday, October 9th at 7 at the West Bank Regional Library on Manhattan Boulevard in Harvey. Megan Abbott, author of 10 books, including Give Me Your Hand, Dare Me, and You Will Know Me, and Sarah St. Vincent, author of Ways to Hide in Winter, are the recipients of the Diana Pinkley Prizes for Crime Fiction. They will be presented Thursday, October 10th at 6 at the Louisiana Humanities Center at 938 Lafayette Street. Open to the public, but please RSVP to pinkleyprizes@gmail.com. Today's guest, Robert Brantley, discusses Insign's Sacred Ground, Cemeteries of New Orleans, Thursday, October 10th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop, and again Thursday, October 17th at 6 at Octavia Books. Celeste Norris discusses Insign's Cajun by Blood, a Thibodeau family story, Thursday, October 10th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Rachel Brenlin and Bruce Sunpie Barnes, co-authors of Le Cour Creole, The Creole Heart, Creole Compositions and Stories from Louisiana, discuss and sign the book at the opening of the accompanying exhibit at the Cabildo, 701 Charters. That's Friday, October 11th at 5:30. Jeanette Weiland discusses and signs her children's book, Beignets for Breakfast, Saturday, October 12th at 4 at Garden District Bookshop. And coming up, Garden District Bookshop presents an evening with Chef Sean Brock in conversation with Chef Kelly Fields, discussing his book, South, Essential Recipes and New Explorations. That's at the New Orleans Culinary and Hospitality Institute, 725 Howard Avenue, October 17th at 7. Tickets available at Garden District Bookshop. Octavia Books presents Hillary Rodham Clinton and Chelsea Clinton discussing their new book, Gutsy Women, Favorite Stories of Courage and Resilience, Saturday, October 26th at 11:30 a.m. at St. Charles Avenue Presbyterian Church. Tickets are available at Eventbrite and Octavia Books. Octavia Books also presents Ta-Nehisi Coates, reading and discussing his first novel, Water Dancer, in conversation with novelist Jessamyn Ward, Wednesday, October 30th at 6 at Temple Sinai, 6227 St. Charles Avenue. Tickets available at Octavia Books. Don't forget to listen in next Tuesday at 7:44 a.m. during Morning Edition and 5:44 p.m. during All Things Considered for our new series, Thinking Outside the Book. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org.